This episode of Data Knots is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code DATANAUTS30.
People love to disrupt things. Just look at today's data center when contrasted to, heck, only a few years ago. It's a wild, changing world filled with a lot of spectacular opportunities for individuals who can float atop the various new ideas and pluck the ones out that are worth pursuing, especially when learning across technology silos to build really snazzy solutions for their company. This is, however, easier said than done. How do you break out of your comfort zone to find techniques to master and skills worth gaining? It's no small task, but never fear, my friends. We have a special guest today to discuss his journey through the black morass that is being a technical professional. And hello to the Data Knots podcast. I am Chris Wall. You can follow me at Chris Wall on the Twitters. And with me is my co-host, fresh off a yak shaving expedition off the third planet from Sol, Ethan Banks. He's at EC Banks on the Twitters. And this is the Data Knots podcast. You can find this and all of our shows on iTunes in your favorite podcatcher, or at packpushers.net. Let's start out where we need to start, with an introduction to our snazzy guest, Mr. Matt Simmons. Welcome to the show, and if you could tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do, my friend.
Hey, thanks, Chris. I am about a 15-year Linux admin at this point. I've done network virtualization, some storage. I blog, I tweet more than I should, and now I am working in Los Angeles, California at an aerospace provider. Very exciting and cool to kind of get around different parts of industries and see what different people are doing where. And thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk.
I don't think it's possible to tweet too much. You say, you know, like you tweet too much. I don't know if that's necessarily possible. We'll debate that another time. And also wanted to point out, you're quite famous in certain circles because you were kind of joined at the hip with Mr. Stephen Foskett for Tech Field Day for a number of years. That's how we were introduced as his, were you a pirate or something? I forget the title, the funny title that you had.
My title depended on the different events as we kind of went through. But yeah, no, I was his work spouse, so to speak. I was responsible for making sure that Tech Field Day stuff happened and that Stephen was happy. And that was beyond a full-time job.
Yeah, and you were the original Dread Pirate Roberts, as I recall.
That was
very possible.
Excellent. It's hard to keep perfection happy, but you did a great job. Let's go ahead and riff on a little bit about full-stack engineering and kind of what it means. I think it's a bit of a newer type term in our field and traditionally has been more associated with the developer side of the house. So Matt, I know you're more on the operations side of things. And when I say full stack engineering, a head full, what does this mean to you? Is it a marketing phrase or do you think it has real applications in modern data center operations?
I think the phrase itself is probably a marketing phrase when used to look for potential people to come in. I mean, taken literally, it's completely imaginary, right? So nobody is a full stack engineer. There's nobody out there that's writing firmware for the devices on the computers that they're using to serve their Node.js websites that they developed using whatever JavaScript front end you want to use now. I mean, like, just nobody's doing that. That's insane. So what you have to do is you have to take it in context and figure, oh, okay, they want me to work the full stack of the infrastructure that I'm responsible for. And really, it's a question of responsibility and maturity. And can you grasp the whole picture of what you've got to deal with? And it does never hurt to be knowledgeable about hardware, but you're not going to be engineering the full stack of anything like that. I really think it's taken the place of like what used to be a senior level engineer or something like that. It's basically, in my experience, like somebody who's comfortable finding the problem and fixing it wherever it is. Maybe the solution is like, oh, we need more hardware and I understand how storage works, so we need to engineer a new solution. And if you don't have a full storage person, then you're the storage person. So get that done.
Okay, see, the way you're describing it, you sound like if you need to be a jack of all trades, then that's what you do. And maybe that's what full stack engineering is in a sense. You know, and if you've got a bunch of skills, maybe we should go back to the beginning, because how did you get started in all of this? How did you get in the door with technology and then begin to grow those skills?
Oh, so I In a longer story than I have time to tell, I would start with, I found a computer in a field, which is the absolute truth. I traded that computer for some Linux CDs before Linux was really a thing that anybody had heard of. We're talking like 95, 96. And installed Slackware.
I was just going to say it was Slackware, wasn't it? Yeah.
Of course it was Slack. What else are you going to use? Yeah, and eventually I went to work for a mom-and-pop ISP as a tech support person. I knew Linux more than the admins did. They took me under their wing. It was like an 80s montage, and I became an admin.
Did you have a t-shirt that said, in a world without Windows, who needs Gates?
Oh, probably. I did actually get kicked out of the Windows 2000 release party for distributing Linux CDs.
That's awesome.
That's like distributing illegal drugs at a kid's party, man. That's just not cool. Don't do that.
I used to carry around the hologram invitation card, you know, to prove to people like that I had actually went, because it was like a badge of honor. It was really funny. The guy, if you remember, there was a Walnut Creek CD-ROM place, and then there was a guy that I think may have been affiliated, maybe not, called Cheap Bytes. You could order Linux CDs for like a buck a pop back when Linux took a long time to download because, hey, 600 and however many megs was a lot. So I emailed the guy, and I'm like, look, I got this invite to this party. I want to go take Linux CDs. How do you burn so many CDs? What can I do to burn CDs? And he's like, well, I could totally tell you how to do it, but you're going to get a ton of errors. Why don't I just send you a bunch at cost? And so he overnighted me an entire spindle of, I think it was Mandrake. And so my friends and I all went and we just handed them out to people like candy, and we got kicked out. It was a good time. That's how I got into it. I got in by like exploring what my gap in my knowledge was. So I didn't know how to fix my computer when I broke it. So I learned, and then I learned how to fix other people's computers when they were broken. And then the level and degree of, you know, what was broken just kept increasing as I went. So advanced to servers and networks, infrastructures, and I'm still doing it. I'm still learning how to fix things that are broken.
Yeah, just keep finding gaps. It sounds like realistically what you're talking about is that you like to troubleshoot or solve problems, which I think is the base skill underlying everything in IT. And every time you hit a point where it's like, I don't know the answer, you get kind of excited and it's like, now I want to know what the answer is. I didn't know that question even existed. And that's how you're spreading across the various silos within this kind of full stack type nomenclature.
Yeah, it's all about gaps, right? Like, I have this gap in my knowledge, but now I need to do that. Well, I could just not do it. Or for real, I could just figure it out and dive in, read a book, read blogs, figure out how to get the information, and then share it. And that's what my career has been about, you know, learning what I don't know and then trying to tell other people so they don't have to work as hard to find it. That's why I started a blog. That's why I, you know, tweet a lot of tech stuff. Just got to share interesting things and try to make the world a better place a little bit.
Now, if it started with Linux and doing that sort of sysadmin work, you said working for the mom and pop ISP, at what point do you say it's time to expand my skills? Is it just what we were saying a second ago, just whenever something popped up? Or from a career perspective, did you take a more serious look and say, I need to dive into whatever else you've learned over the years?
Well, I grew up in West Virginia, and that was not the most technologically forward place. It's a very lovely people for the most part. But I wanted to grow and increase. And this mom and pop was in West Virginia. And I thought, you know, I have learned basically what I'm going to learn here. And so I didn't want it to be boring. I'm a neophyte. I'm fascinated by anything new, by anything I don't know. And I had reached the point where I was basically just like finding more clever ways to set up Radius. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. So I took a job as a PHP programmer in Columbus, Ohio, mostly because it was in Columbus, Ohio. And then I 6 months later found this financial services job that I was in for a while. And I thought, well, this is new. I've not done this. And really, I felt myself leveling up as a sysadmin there because we were responsible for billions of dollars under management. And I had no idea what I was doing. So I had to learn, and I had to learn fast. So I stayed there until I was like very, very senior level in terms of like what I knew. And Chris, this is when we met, was when I had this job. And it was basically like, oh, well, I would discover new technologies as I had a need for them in the infrastructure. Like, I didn't really ever run Windows servers until like I needed centralized authentication. I'm like, well, I could set up Linux, but like Active Directory is a way better solution. And that's what actually switched me over from Slackware to RHEL at that time, because Slackware still doesn't do PAM, but RHEL does. And I was like, oh, well, I just need to switch the entire infrastructure over to this so I can have centralized authentication. And then I did that. And I'm like, all right, cool. But now I have this problem because I need to start virtualizing things. okay, so let's build virtualization. Well, if you want to get the most out of virtualization, you need centralized storage. So we should really get some kind of SAN solution going on. And get the SAN solution with, you know, virtualization and all of this stuff just kind of builds and builds and builds and builds. And so I'm building this infrastructure that has all kinds of like aspects to things that I didn't know were things before I needed them. And I feel like as an industry, that's kind of this voyage of discovery that we go on. If you look back even to the beginning of DevOps, DevOps was really a result of the need for a web-based rapid development environment that didn't exist before the mid-90s. You know, you had used to have this waterfall software design where somebody would write the software, it would get released as a version, and it would get shipped out to stores, and then your next release cycle might be a few months away, so you had a lot of time to fix bugs and then release that version. But with a web, you know, you needed a much quicker response. You needed to turn over quickly. You needed more feedback. And DevOps came as a result of, well, the software is changing so fast. We need the infrastructure to change too. How do we make sure the people who run the infrastructure and the people who write the software are in cahoots so they can make the changes in lockstep so that the entire environment changes as the needs of the business change? And so it's all about this interrelationship and how do you encourage that communication? And so that has really driven the IT operations people to need to build a tool set and a language that's much more similar to developers than it has been to operations in the past. You know, I use a lot of development tools now. Most modern admins do use a development toolkit and a development workflow. There are just all kinds of things that are different than traditional operations roles where you used to log into servers and, you know, like a break fix cycle, like edit the Apache config, restart Apache. Oh, that didn't work. I'm going to edit the Apache config again. That kind of thing doesn't scale anymore. You can't do that in most large infrastructures. So you have to find new ways to do it.
One of the things I got chatting with Matt is this passion that came out of him for technology in general. And I think that the conclusion I came to here, this thought kind of popped in my head, people who are passionate about technology aren't bound by silos. And I've worked with people who it's like, I do the network and that's all I do. I don't want to know anything else because this is my thing and I don't want to get any more responsibility on me. Teflon guy, except for the one thing they want to do. But if you really love technology, silos aren't a thing to you. You just dig in. And that seemed to be what Matt was all about. And I really identified with that.
Absolutely. It's definitely dangerous to say not my problem or not my area of expertise. I mean, don't destroy production and things like that. And obviously, you have things you have to do and prioritize. But if you're given the opportunity to learn something else, why say no? And my takeaway is I like that we dissected full stack engineer into more of like, I don't know, mostly stack engineer or maybe more aptly, not just one part of the stack engineer. Meaning, yeah, you can't literally know everything there is to know, but I think the idea is just that you're broader than one or two particular silos within the stack. And I personally like that Matt used the word cahoots with respect to DevOps.
This episode of Datanauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you gain access to the most important tools needed to prepare you for IT certification. For instance, we've got over 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content, and 50 hours are added each week. Courses are streamed live and on-demand worldwide to your Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, 4th-gen Apple TV, or, of course, your PC. Plus, you can learn on the go with your mobile device. Course topics include CompTIA, Advanced Security Practitioner, Ethical Hacking, Virtualization, Cryptography, Metasploit, and more. And the new for March 2016, CCNP security courses, Microsoft Server 2016 MCSE, and Microsoft System Center Configuration Manager. With IT Pro TV, you get over 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs and Transcender practice exams. That's a $109 value. And you get all of that for one low monthly subscription price. And by the way, if you try it and don't like it, there is a no-hassle cancellation policy. Also, there is corporate or group pricing available, and clients that have taken advantage of that include Harvard, MIT, UCSD, Stanford, and others. So check out itpro.tv/datanauts to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANAUTS30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off for the lifetime of your account. That is less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/datanauts, use the code datanauts30, and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account. Well, Matt, at the end, you grew in your career. You started getting into DevOps and some new tools, and maybe you could fast forward a bit to today and share with us some of the things that you're using today, the tools that are making your life easier for you and your team, because it sounds like you operate in a DevOps environment.
Yeah, I think that's probably true for the most part. So the results that you get and the techniques that you use to achieve them are largely driven by the needs of the business, I found. In the current environment that I'm in, which is a modern aerospace company, the needs change rapidly and we need to do quickly. Things that we used to take weeks, now we need to have happen in minutes. How do you do that? Well, what we have done is we have really implemented a developer-centric workflow. I, in particular, work with a flight software group that writes code that runs on embedded devices. And they have environmental needs on their machines, and I have found myself using a workflow where I will treat my infrastructure as code as much as I possibly can. So we use configuration management, and everything is stored inside of Git repos. So you can totally check out a Git repo, make a change, commit it, and then, you know, it goes up to the server.
Okay, so let's back up a second here. So Git as in GitHub, and then you've got some configuration tool that is pulling configuration data from the GitHub repository and pushing it out to infrastructure. Is that the context where you mean infrastructure as code?
Yeah, so I use a configuration management software. In particular, I use Puppet. It's what I'm most familiar with. And with my team, it's just a lot of brain trust with Puppet. So Puppet is largely stuff that looks like source code. It's really a configuration description. So you're describing, here's the code that executes the change on the machine, and here is a description of how that code should be configured to run. A Puppet master, in this case, says, oh, this node has this software configuration. I need to make sure that the software and the environment on that node is set up in the way that has been described in this set of text files. So it compiles all of the software and the description for how it should all be running, and then it applies that to the machine, and it makes any changes if necessary.
And exactly that. It does what's necessary. It knows the configuration that exists. It knows where we're trying to get to, and it's not just loading a new config. It's actually more intelligent than that, where it knows what's on the device versus what needs to be on the device and makes appropriate changes, yes?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I would advise, if you're catching up to the Datanauts, we had a great show on configuration management with Rob Nelson talking around Puppet and Ansible and Chef and whatnot, and he goes pretty deep into config management. And man, I'm thinking, all right, you're using something like this, but where did you learn? I mean, first of all, Git, I suppose. It tends to be something that I tend to preach to the ops folks, but get some pushback that it's difficult to learn and for devs and things like that. I mean, it sounds like you, A, don't think it's just for devs, and B, where did you actually get your feet wet with Git?
Oh, yeah. So, first, unequivocally, version control in general, not just for developers. Think back to when you were in an environment where you needed to edit the Apache config, right? You just were like working on a live server, you're editing the Apache config, you screw it up. That's bad. Now you've got to work double hard to fix it because you have to fix whatever you broke and then whatever was broken originally. So now you've got two problems. Version control is about, what if we took this and we saved it, right? And then we work on this copy of it. And then, you know, we work forward like that and we can always go back to this backup that we have. And everybody does that, right? So if you're editing an Apache config, you know, you copy httpd.conf over to httpd.conf.back, right? Like that's just kind of a natural human, oh, I understand I should save a copy of that. Version control does that, but in a much more intelligent way. And so as an admin, I got into Subversion pretty early on, which is more simplistic. I don't mean it in a detrimental way, but it is a simpler version control that has the ability to have a server and you say, all right, I'm going to change this file and I'm going to save it in Subversion. And that pushes that change up to another machine, possibly, where you have the centralized repo and it acts as an offsite backup and you can, check out on several machines. Okay, cool. Git does that, but in a distributed way. So you can save locally and you can save remotely and other people can save locally and remotely on their stuff. So what it basically does is it allows you to collaborate with many people on the same piece of shared configuration or code or whatever you're dealing with. And it allows you to merge and treat this shared resource in a way that recognizes that different people are working on different parts and allows you to resolve conflicts in a well-established way. Right now, I use a private internal Git repo, but in my public life, I use GitHub a lot. And GitHub is a free service for public project hosting, and it uses Git on the back end, and it is super awesome. And you can actually easily contribute to any piece of software stored on GitHub because it's basically available. You go, you clone the repo that houses the software, and that makes a copy and puts it in your space. And then you can make changes to your space. And then when you are happy with these changes, you create a pull request that allows the original author to look at your changes and say, yeah, these changes are great. I want to pull these in. Or, you know, these changes are good, but it would be better if you did it like this. And then you can make your changes and then, you know, finally have it pulled in.
Right.
It allows for a really nice culture of sharing and collaboration that just was really hard to do before.
Did you know that I've actually contributed to Docker that way? Do you know what I contributed to them?
No, what?
They misspelled VMware.
So you fixed their documentation.
W. Yeah, yeah. I corrected the W from uppercase to lowercase, and I am now a contributor to Docker.
That's outstanding.
It's the greatest day of my life. But I think there's a lot of good points there. The fact that you said it's a little simpler than Subversion, yes. Or Subversion is simpler type software, and that comes with its certain caveats and bonuses. You know, simpler meaning, yeah, you had to have a master that was online, and if it wasn't, there was issues, and you had to be connected to it in some way, whereas Git is distributed, which has a lot of benefits, I think. The fact that you can just crank out some code on your laptop and shoot it off to something. But also, the thing that I like is that I can go onto something like GitHub and see the raw code. You know, you can look and see for ideas, to see how someone's thinking, to get your own ideas as far as that's a lot of the internet was just copy something cool that someone else did and then add your own kind of flavor to it. And that's something I like about it too.
Matt, let me change gears on you. Git is, we grasp that concept, version control and all that. I want to go in a different direction, though. We've been talking a lot about containers on the show. And of course, it's all in the news, Docker and CoreOS and the Open Container Project and so on. Are you using containers in your world or not?
You know, I'm really not. So this is my opinion, I would say, or at least my observations. And that's that containers are very, very good for ephemeral versioned infrastructure. So if you're deploying a particular version of something and you know you're going to continue to deploy that and you want to iteratively improve it as you deploy it and roll out new versions and roll back old versions, containers are awesome for that. In my particular infrastructure, I don't have a lot of use cases for something like that. Plus, I don't actually have that many services that are running that are broken down into microservices. So I have way too many giant monolithic machines where the only answer is to scale up because the piece of commercial software that we bought for this particular function decided that that was the right way to do it. And nobody thinks it's a good idea. It's just the way it is.
And so it's an application problem. You don't have applications that are going to fit into a container infrastructure, really.
Not many.
You'd be forcing the issue if you were trying to make it work like that.
The one thing that I've been looking at to build out some amount of containerization is actually related to our previous topic a little bit. I told you how our workflow is in terms of revving Puppet code, right? So I do a decent amount of Puppet development, and I do that in a piece of software called Vagrant by HashiCorp. It's free, and everybody should be using it because it's amazing. But it basically acts as a front end to a virtualization platform, VirtualBox by default, but it can be whatever. So I write code in Vagrant on virtual machines, and then I apply it. It has Puppet provisioners and things like that, so you can test your Puppet config. And then when you're ready and you want to put it in real life, I commit the code up to the repo, and we have a continuous integration, continuous development kind of software that looks at the repos, and it's constantly watching. And when it sees a commit, it will pull it out, and it will test it. And this piece of software is Bamboo from Atlassian. The act of pulling it out and running it is one where it needs an environment to run it in. By default, and right now, we just have some nodes sitting around that are specifically for that. But I can definitely see a use case where it spins up an environment catered to the piece of software that I have started to configure, and it goes and spins up a containerized environment for that, tests the code, tears down the container, and then it'll be much faster and much less resource intensive.
You're always going to have a very clean, sanitized, and predictable test bed rather than
Absolutely.
Oh, the previous test forgot to remove artifact XYZ, and now it's not a true test anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Which is something, I mean, that I think probably everybody sees whenever they have static nodes that are asked to do stuff like this. Stuff doesn't clean up after itself correctly, and different tests running at different things at the same time interact in ways that you didn't anticipate. I mean, it's all part of the systems theory, but yeah.
That's... And the challenge was trying to spin up completely clean lab/test environments every time wasn't really feasible because, you know, cloning the VM and getting it all integrated. And that process was non-trivial. It was kind of heavy. It took a while. And the idea that you're presenting to me here is that the container is so quick and easy and declarative in nature that you could just spin it up, test, and throw it away and not really care about it.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like that's the perfect use case for containers. There are probably some application groups internally that over time will architect themselves towards microservices, where you can kind of separate out the discrete functions of the software, and then there'll be good cases for containerization. But just in our particular environment with what we do, it's not a panacea, right? It doesn't solve every problem. And in our case, it's not the right solution in a lot of cases.
That was super interesting. I like hearing about Git and GitHub. They make me warm and tingly. And hearing Matt talk, the thing that I took away from the previous conversation was that containers are just not going to eat the data center carte blanche. They're one way to provide a service and actually abstract away compute. It's worth looking at your use cases. And if you want to start in the world of containerization, based on some previous shows that we've had and some guests that have poured their experience out, Matt's kind of echoed it. The world of CI/CD is a great place to start. Those are the applications that tend to lend well for your baby's first foray into containerization. Ethan, where's your head at?
I was focused on Git. So I have a computer science degree and a programming background from back in the day. And Git, I have an account and have done very little with it. It's all a bit obtuse trying to get into Git at first because the terminology and what you're really doing is a bit challenging, but I got to get back in there. And one of the things that prompted that was the way Matt was talking about it and how it's really useful Git is as a collaboration tool. I mean, yeah, you get version control and code repository, and that's fine just for you yourself. But I think the big deal with Git is that ability to share code with other people. You get a big power multiplier there. I have some little coding projects that I need to do that is like clicking in my head. Yes, this makes sense. I need to use Git so that I can easily share with other people some of the bits of code that I'm putting together.
Well, I really enjoyed the conversation around what you're using and the value of it, things like Git, GitHub, version control, things like that. And I think it's worth now taking a step even further into the future. Let's look at tomorrow. The thing that I'm still picking apart, I'm not quite sure what I believe yet. It's this idea of the subject matter expert, the SME. Is the SME role going to largely die as we move in the forward? Is it a dead idea, or are we still going to need these people versus the jack of all trades, master of none? What do you think,
these people.
Yeah.
people. What do you say by these people? Honestly, no. No, I think subject matter experts are going to become more valuable. We have approached a time where it's impossible to be an actual real expert in anything except a very deep niche of something, right? Like I remember at one point in time, you could be an expert in computer security. How fractured would your expertise have to be in order to actually be an expert now?
I mean, unless you're Beaker, then yeah, that's the only person I can think of who might claim the title. But yes, I think I see what you're talking about. There's too much going on to be an expert in a field holistically.
Yeah. I mean, I know that in large companies, there are people who, I mean, you're not the storage expert, you are the NetApp guy. If you're maybe the whatever the hybrid storage solution is guy, or maybe you hire that guy, but you hire somebody who is excellent at that and maybe a few other things that are not all that dissimilar from that, whatever this is. But I look at it and you need both. You definitely need the jack of all trades, master of none, although it's really, really better to be a pretty good jack of all trades, you know?
I've looked at this, Matt. My take has been it's good to be a jack of all trades, but you're still going to be a master at something. So it's like you were saying, well, yeah, there's still going to be SMEs. Right. I think that's true. There's still going to be, you're really good at something, networking, storage, some particular platform, some bit of software that you're the ace. You dug deep and you really learned that thing super well, typically during a build project or a bunch of troubleshooting exercises, that kind of thing. That knowledge is never going to go away. But to be truly effective, that can't be the only thing you do. You've got to know all this other stuff too to really bring your A game to the infrastructure team, right?
Yes. Yes, I agree. And I also agree that in order to be really effective at solving problems, you need to be the kind of person who can address arbitrary technology and discover problems in it. And I think that's really, really what it's all about when it comes to this division and skill set. You are not necessarily going to be the person that takes a piece of technology down to the bare bones and puts it back together, right? You need to be able to understand what goes into that. You can't just spend the minority of your time flittering back and forth between projects and not digging into the technology and not digging into understanding the relationships. I think the most effective people right now are, I'm going to take flack for saying this, but I don't mean it to be derogatory at all, but they're IT plumbers. So a startup company today, the company itself is not a jack of all trades. The company exists to do something. So you're going to do whatever it is that you're good at, and everything else you should not concentrate on. You should buy those other services because you're wasting your time on things that you are not an expert in as a company. And so as an operations person who's responsible for your company being able to conduct its business, you need to tie together all of these things that you're buying, all these services that you're buying. You know, you're probably not running your own email server. You're probably not running your own phone system. You're probably not running your own, all of these things. You need to figure out how to make them all work together. And you're probably writing code to do it because now the world consists of an API. Everything is an API. Everything needs an API. And you need to make them all talk together if you are in that role. I feel like you might have an expertise. Maybe your expertise is a good match for what the company's expertise is too. If you are the company that runs the mail server, maybe you are the expert in mail servers. But you also need to figure out how to make the other things work together because our roles are not singular in technology. They're not singular in purpose. We have to be jack of all trades. It kind of behooves us to figure out, like, okay, we have our area of expertise. Maybe we do need to figure out deeply and effectively how to operate this wide array of technologies. And that's one of the reasons that there are 15, 20, 50, however many layers of abstraction on top of everything now.
No, that makes sense. And I don't think that's even necessarily a startup specific thing. But yes, if you are a startup, you have such limited capital for hiring folks, especially you want to get folks that can overlay as many topics as possible. You don't want to hire 10 people to run ops. You want to hire one or two that can do a lot of things pretty darn good rather than 10 people that can do things superbly good. So I can see some value there. Absolutely. And on that note, Matt, I wanted to thank you very much for coming here and offloading the great wisdom that you have from your experiences. And I was hoping you could plug some of the places that people can follow you on the interwebs.
Oh, sure. Thanks, Chris. Right now, the most effective way to talk to me, see what I'm doing, is on Twitter. I'm at StandaloneSA. I have a blog that I never have time to write in. It's at standalone-sysadmin.com. And I do occasionally, when I do code publicly, it's on GitHub. I also want to throw in a plug for Lisa. I'm co-chairing with John Arishute, Lisa 16, which is in Boston. It's the first week of December, and it's going to be a great time. It's an IT operations conference for sysadmins, operations admins, people who do what we do. So check it out. We'll put the link in the show notes, and it's going to be a really good time.
Boston, I have no excuse not to go. That's the closest metro.
And you have 8 months of heads up.
Yeah, I know, right? I should really got to figure out how to get down there.
You guys should submit something. Let me just say that. If you guys have anything you want to talk about, or any of your listeners have anything they want to talk about to a bunch of IT admins, good talks. If this airs in time anyway, check out the website. See if we're still accepting submissions.
I was supposed to do Elisa last year, and I had to back out because I ran into a conflict that I couldn't make it out to. It was Seattle or wherever it was last year. Yeah, maybe I should try again.
Yeah, didn't you go to that hot dog eating contest, Ethan? Wasn't
that might have been it. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, that's what it was.
It's all about priorities.
That concludes today's Data Knots podcast. You can reach Ethan. He's at EC Banks on the Twitters or his blog, ethancbanks.com. And I'm Chris at Chris Wall on the Twitters. And my blog is wallnetwork.com. For more timely and technical Data Knots podcasts, they're so magical and delicious, you have to download them. Direct your internet-attached browser to packetpushers.net. You will find every Data Knots podcast we've ever recorded. with discussions about infrastructure engineering, cloud, containers, storage, certifications, home labs, hot dog eating contests, and more. And if you like what we're doing, throw us a bone. Give us a review on iTunes. Give us a shout out on Twitter. Give us a virtual high five. We always appreciate the love. Until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Glass of, air quotes, water.
Looks like vodka. All right, here we go.